All right, so we're going to get started. So we have four presentations right now. So this is the next round of rotations, and you've already heard everybody's names. And I'm going to basically bow out, aside from just standing up at the end of 15 minutes. So Cassandra's starting.
Great. So hi, I'm Cassandra Ex-DeVore. I work at Harvard University, and my lab mostly works on the evolution and development of animals, and we're most interested in the evolution. I'm most interested in the evolution of genetic programs that tell cells what to do, how to be different from each other. And the main difference, I think, is very interesting, is the difference between reproductive and non-reproductive cells. But I'm not going to, that's all I'm going to say. We can talk later about that kind of thing. The stuff that we've brought for you from my lab today is a bunch of different insects so that you can compare a really interesting aspect of cell biology, which is syncytial cell biology. So you've seen something of that in Drosophila, where you know that a syncytium is basically a cell that has a lot of different nuclei in it. In this case, it's generated by a failure of, by an absence of cytokinesis, I don't want to judge it, at the end of early mitosis, which is different, it's not worse. So as you know, Drosophila does this, right? And so instead of having a two-cell stage, they have a two-nucleus stage, and then they have a four-nucleus stage, not a four-cell stage. Then they do this 13 times synchronously, as you all learned about in the last couple of weeks. What I'm going to tell you in the next 10 minutes is that Drosophila shares syncytial development with other insects. Almost all other insects go through syncytial development, which, by the way, is a weirdness in animal development. Really only in arthropods display syncytial development. It's a bizarre thing. However, across the insects, there's a lot of diversity in various aspects of the cell biology of this syncytial cleavage, and so we've brought some different insects for you that we are pretty sure may be in many respects more representative of an ancestral insect, possibly an ancestral arthropod, than Drosophila is. And so insect radiation probably occurred about 600 million years ago. What I mean by that is that the last common ancestor of all today's living insects probably existed about 600 million years ago. And in that time, there's been a lot of variation. And so I'm just going to show you a little bit of the variation. So this is fruit fly life cycle, which you kind of know about. Female lays an egg, and then egg hatches into a maggot. And then this maggot crawls around and eats and gets big, forms a pupa. Inside the pupa, total revolution, like Clark Kent inside the, you know. Why did he always hide that also? Like, why did, I would tell everybody I was Superman if I, okay. So he totally changes shape inside, and then you get another life cycle. This type of development is called indirect development. In insects, we call it holometabolous development because the holometabola is the name of the monophyletic clade that includes all insects that go through this development. Holometabolous or indirect development is an evolutionary novelty in insects. Within animals, indirect development has evolved multiple times independently. And in insects, the group of insects that does that, it evolved once. It's called holometaboly. Okay. At the end of syncytial development, you end up with a nice syncytial blastoderm in Drosophila, as you know, where all of the nuclei are spread more or less evenly across the surface of this egg, right? And this is just a color-coded by depth image. The only point I'm trying to get across here is that you have this very even syncytial blastoderm, and some features of Drosophila cleavage is that its cleavage is synchronous when it's early. These mitotic divisions are synchronous. You've seen that. Basically, almost every single nucleus here, once it cellularizes, will participate in making the embryonic body, which is going to make the body of the larva or the maggot, right? You may know that there's a small group of dorsal nuclei, just maybe a few hundred up there, that do not go into the body of the embryo. Instead, they form an extra embryonic membrane called the amniocerosa. Okay. And another thing that you probably have learned about Drosophila is that all of the segments of the body, a segment is an important synapomorphy of arthropods, is that they're all defined, every segment knows what it is, and all the segments that the body will ever have are already decided and made by the end of the blastoderm stage. Okay. Those are things that are true of Drosophila development. And you've learned now how to make some beautiful movies of Drosophila development by using transgenic lines that have fluorescently colored stuff, like fluorescently colored histones, as in this case. And you know that the nuclei can be tracked, and you've learned how to do some of that tracking. And this is just one of, you know, you could pull this movie from the internet, and I'm sure your movies are way better. So I'm not going to belabor the point, but I just wanted to remind you of that. Now, the other thing that I want to emphasize here is that the way that Drosophila develops, all of these aspects that I've talked about, this uniform blastoderm, participation of almost every blastoderm nucleus in the body of the embryo, segmentation being completed by the end of the blastoderm stage, all of those are bizarre alien features restricted only to a small group of insects, not representative of most insects at all. So if we look at where insects are in the grand scheme of arthropod phylogeny, this is a highly simplified phylogeny with just a handful of arthropod species. You've got, here's a few insects. Drosophila, this is a silk moth. This is a beetle. This is a wasp and a bee. These guys form a monophyletic clade. That means they share one last common ancestor. These all develop indirectly, holometabolous insects. Branching basally to them are way more insects than I've shown here. Here's just a couple. And they are called the hemimetabolous insects. They do not develop indirectly. They develop directly just like you did. The product of embryogenesis is a small version of the adult, but it has all the parts. And then it just physically gets larger. Okay. And then, sister to all of the rest of the insects, or I should say really embedded, insects are embedded within crustaceans. This is a type of crustacean here. And in case you don't follow arthropod phylogeny, maybe you don't, this is really now the real thing. Insects are just crustaceans. Crustaceans and insects are all one monophyletic group. Crustaceans are not a natural monophyletic group on their own. And then sister to these guys, the pancrustacea, we call them now, we have your millipedes and centipedes, and then the most basally branching arthropods are your spiders and scorpions and stuff like that. Okay, so we just think about insects. These are roughly all the orders of insects, right, all the major groups. And we've got flies down here in this monophyletic clade of holometabola here. Here's some other, here are all the other holometabolous groups, but the vast majority of insects, as you can see, of insect orders, are hemimetabolous. They are basally branching, probably closer to a last common ancestor in many respects, and flies, as I've just implied, are highly derived in many aspects of their development. And so here's some aspects of the development that they're really different in, and I'm going to illustrate those with the other insects that we brought for you, which is a cricket species and a beetle species. Okay, so this beetle is also an indirect developer, holometabolous. It's going through complete metamorphosis. So the adult is laying some eggs. The eggs are hatching into larvae. These larvae have prolegs. Like, we don't call them legs, we call them prolegs. I don't know, because they're small. Okay, these legs do not become the real adult legs. Okay, they just exist in the larva. The real adult legs are going to be made in different ways during puparation, and then you'd start the whole thing again. So these guys are holometabolous, indirect developing, just like the flies, but their embryogenesis is very different, okay? And what we're gonna do this afternoon is put up some stuff on the wiki so that you can see some movies and some references, but I'm just gonna show you a couple snapshots here taken by Frederick Strobel and his colleagues a couple years ago using the spin microscope or this light sheet technology that I think you were able to observe briefly with Sebastian sometime in the last couple of weeks. So these are just, the top row is one view, a ventral view, so looking at it from the belly side. The bottom row is a lateral view, looking at it from the side. And this starts, these snapshots begin after the blastoderm stage. But I will fill in this part for you and tell you that Tribolian does form a uniform blastoderm. So, you know, if you scaled it and stretched it a little bit, you could pretend that it was a Drosophila embryo. In terms of uniform distribution of nuclei, syncytially, across the surface of the egg. However, what you can see happens here, and this is just the beginning of the time point. This is not zero as in the beginning of fertilization. Okay, this is just when they started their movies, but this would take a couple hours at 25 degrees to get to this point. You can see that now there's an unequal distribution of nuclei across the surface. Some are condensing over on one side. The other ones are more loosely distributed. This condensation forms this, you know, peanut-shaped whatever. That thing is the embryonic rudiment. That will be the embryo. All the other cells will not be the embryo. They will be extra-embryonic membrane. But they will be two different extra-embryonic membranes, not just one dinky one called amniocerosa, like in flies. They'll make two big ones. One is called the amnion, and it stretches on the ventral side, and it covers them like you're covered by a sheet when you're in your bed or something. The other one is called the serosa. It's attached to the head, and it goes all the way around the back, the dorsal side, and is also attached to the posterior of the embryo and encloses the yolk, which is sitting behind them, basically. So like a chicken embryo, if you've ever seen that, or a fish embryo, if you've ever seen that, or if you eat eggs and you crack one open and it was fertilized, you see a little thing on the top of it. That's the embryo floating on top of the yolk. That's how most arthropods develop. You'd never know this if you only studied Drosophila. All right, so here's the embryo on top. It's now being covered on the ventral side by the amnion, which grows down over on top of it. And Tribolium, conveniently, for most of its embryonic development, basically stays like a chicken floating on top of the yolk. Crickets, which you'll find out if you end up working with us, form initially in the same way. So we've got some fertilization, we've got some syncytial cleavages, we've got a blastoderm. And I mean, this little schematic is a little misleading because we know that in crickets, the blastoderm is not particularly uniform, even from its very first formation. The specific dynamics of that uniformity or lack thereof have not been quantified. That could be something you might be interested in. Then we have a condensation of some nuclei, and I'll show you a movie of this a little bit later, into the embryonic rudiment, or we also call it the germ rudiment sometimes. Then this little germ rudiment kind of looks like a weird flattened butterfly, gets longer and longer. Now, it's getting longer and longer. It's not just redistributing the cells that it already has. It's doing at least two more important things. It's creating more cells, so dividing, dividing, dividing. Also, it needs to create extra segments, because the segment identities that exist within this rudiment here are only the segments of the head and the segments of the thorax. That's the part where the legs come out. But not the segments of the abdomen. The embryonic rudiment does not have any abdominal segments specified. Instead, it has to create the tissue to make the abdominal segments off the posterior end, and then it has to divide them into segments. If any of you are familiar with vertebrate embryogenesis, you'll know that we are segmented, and that during our embryogenesis, we also grew in this process of axial elongation and progressive anterior to posterior segmentation. That's how snakes do it, that's how fish do it, that's how we do it. That's how most arthropods do it, not Drosophila. Okay. So embryonic rudiment forms on the surface. It's not bad, it's just different. Embryonic rudiments form on the surface. Cricket embryos, once they're formed, as they're elongating, are simultaneously sinking into the yolk. So if I were a cricket embryo forming lying on the ventral side of a yolk mass, which is sitting behind me behind the screen, basically what I would do is just disappear into the yolk and you wouldn't be able to see me, which poses optical challenges, as you can imagine, which I'm sure you will prove equal to. And so it's doing a lot of things simultaneously. It's dividing, it's elongating, it's segmenting, it's sinking into the yolk. It's also, and if we have time at the end, I will show you a movie that illustrates this. It's also reversing its orientation relative to the orientation of the egg. All right. When the rudiment first forms, this also is the case in Tribolium. I go back here, the anterior of the egg is at the top of these pictures, and the head of the embryo, the anterior of the embryo, is also pointing towards the anterior of the egg. And it stays like that the whole time, okay? And it's going to be born with the head up at the top of the egg, the anterior of the egg. In crickets, they form the embryonic rudiment, the head is pointing towards the anterior of the egg. However, it's changing orientation. Its tail now is pulling around the posterior end of the egg and moving towards the anterior, so that it finishes this revolution such its head is now pointing towards the posterior of the egg. Okay. Then it's going to basically back up and go in reverse. Okay. It's going to go in reverse so that when it hatches, the head is once again pointing towards the anterior of the egg. These extensive embryonic movements have special names that I can tell you later, blastokinesis, blah, blah, blah. They are typical of most insect embryos, not Drosophila. Drosophila doesn't do that. Okay. Okay, so that's pretty interesting. So here is a movie of a transgenic cricket line with histone GFP, or sorry, this might be an actin, a cytoplasmic actin GFP, and it will enable you to see a few of these early syncytial divisions. They're looking pretty synchronous at the beginning. Now they're looking less synchronous. It's a blastoderm. It's not super uniform. You're going to see some condensation of nuclei. Whoa. On one side. The ventral side is facing you. So we're going to have a condensation here, and I'm sorry, the ventral side is down, and that's the initial condensation. So you can see there's a lot of things to understand here that we don't understand. Some of the nuclei are larger, we think they're polyploid and going to become extraembryonic, so almost all the nuclei here on the surface are going to form the extraembryonic membrane, the serosa, stretching around the whole dorsal side, and then they'll have a small extraembryonic membrane there on that side. Now, how big are these cricket embryos? Well, they are a lot bigger than fruit flies. So you'll be pleased to know that, those of you who want to mount them by hand. To get the embryo out, though, to observe it, you need to actually physically remove it out of the embryo by hand, which is also totally feasible. We'll show you how to do that. And it is, you know, around the same diameter, roughly, as a zebrafish embryo, just to give you a little scaling idea.
3 minutes.
Yep, thank you. All right, where are we going? So here's some big differences in cricket and beetle development, despite the fact that the crickets are indirectly developing and the beetles are directly developing. But in both cases, yes, you have synchronous early cleavage, similar to Drosophila, but only some of those cells of the blastoderm go in to make up the embryo, and not all of the segments are defined at the blastoderm stage. Okay, so sorry, that was just an identification of this line, and we have this line here in lab for you to use. Okay, let's go to the next slide. I'm going to skip that movie. And I'm just going to give you, these two insects are not just weird insects that we picked up out of the world. These are insects that other people had already worked out how to culture in lab. And there are a lot of good reasons to work on these things. They're very easy to keep in lab. You can manipulate their genes. Genomes, their sequences are essentially available. So they're pretty tractable. But you do have to dig the embryos out of those things by hand. So these are some of the major differences that you might be interested in and be asking questions. Okay, so these, both of these insects have synchronous divisions and this axial expansion, which is the distribution of the nuclei throughout that space of the egg. But then the contribution to the embryo versus the non-embryo parts is really different in these guys. The segmentation issue is really different in these guys. Some it's sequential ancestrally, but derived state is a simultaneous state. And then also we have this direct and indirect development, which is a big difference between these guys. So this is stuff we brought for you in the lab that you can use. We know you have some transgenic flies from previous module. You can also use those. We brought a few more. We haven't yet compared what we brought with what's here already, so there might be some overlap. We have this transgenic cricket line with the fluorescent histone. We have wild-type tribolium line, and we decided not to bring transgenic tribolium lines, even though they exist, because instead we brought a bunch of mRNAs that encode that will, when they are injected into the embryo, be translated in there and make fluorescently labeled cellular biology components. You can inject them into any of these. We'll show you how to do all the injections, and then they'll be translated. You can color code the different pieces of the cell that you want to look at. We brought some drugs to stop stuff from working. And here's a couple questions just to end up in the last 2 minutes. Stuff you might be interested in answering and stuff that we think we can help you gather quantitative data to address. So the nuclei initially are dividing syncytially inside the yolk, and then they have to come up to the surface, right? And so what are the parameters that describe that emergence and the surface? So you're looking here at a movie that Taro made, looking right at the surface, and the energies are coming up from the bottom, and then they're going to organize themselves and be swimming over there on the surface. So that is an interesting question, and we don't know the dynamics of that. Frankly, we don't know the dynamics of it in Drosophila either, because the imaging before the syncytial blastoderm is very tricky. You could also ask this question that a grad student in my lab is asking at the moment. Some of you might have met him, I think Seth, he came a couple weeks ago, which is when the embryonic rudiment is condensing. This is a cricket embryo, embryonic rudiment forming here next to me. At what stage do these different nuclei know if they're going to participate in this rudiment or they're just going to hang out on the edge? It's not clear, and so you could use different types of tracking particles, for example, that you've used to see how predictable that participation is in these different structures. We also don't know anything really about the cell division patterns that are coincident with the formation of the rudiment or the different membranes. And another thing you could ask is the cytoskeletal dynamics and components, which you can also disrupt with drugs, how they are necessary or not for these different things. So these are those of us who know how to work with all these embryos. We can teach you how to handle them and wrangle them. Taro is here there in the back in the yellow, and Tasos Pavlopoulos is arriving later today, and he's also an expert in spin microscopy. All right, that's what we got. Thanks. You have this. This is what I was using.
Hear me? Yeah. Good. So our lab is mostly interested in the cytoskeleton and mostly the tubulin cytoskeleton and how centrosomes and cilia are important for cells and how they are made, and I'll go a bit into that. And the project that we are bringing are two projects on the evolution of the cytoskeleton and the cell cycle in between species and in disease, okay? And this will be with the two TAs that come from my lab, Katerina Navais and Gael Martey, and with other teams. Yeah, in the same rotation. So what are centrosomes and cilia? I don't know if Wallace, you talked to them? No, okay. So in our cells, we have this structure called the centriole, which is a nine-fold symmetrical structure called the centriole, made of microtubules. And this is very important for many things in our cells. One of them is that it assembles the centrosome. And the centrosome, it's important in many things, like to form to help assemble the mitotic spindle, and again also in many other processes such as polarity and signaling. But also the same structure can have a complete different personality in the cell, which is it goes to the membrane where it templates the formation of cilia. And cilia are really important for many, many, many things in our body. So they're important for motility in many single cell organisms, but also in a spermatozoa, for example. But also motility in many cells. We have our cells in our body which have multiple cilia, and those are really important to move fluid in our body, for example, in the ovaries, in the brain, in our trachea to expel particles. And we have many of these. So these cells have around 200 to 300 cilia. And under each of those cilia, you have a centriole. But also we have, in most of our cells, we have a single cilia. And those are like antennas, which are very important to signal many different signals. And I'll go a bit into that. And then you also have sensory cilia, like the ones which we have in our retina, which are very important to sense light, but we also have for olfaction, for many different things. And so because of that, centrosomes and cilia are really organs of communication in between different scales in our cells and in our environment. So inside cells, in cell division, motility, polarity, DNA damage, in between cells, for example, there is something called the immune synapse, which is very important. That's also templated in the beginning by the centrosome. In between body systems, for example, leptin regulation is mediated by cilia. Within species and host parasite, and also to sense environmental signals, for example, as hearing, vision, and olfaction. So these structures are extremely important and conserved throughout the eukaryotic tree of life. So if you look at different branches of the tree of life, you see organisms with very similar structures, if you look at the centriole, in all of them. Okay? So they've been lost in certain branches of the eukaryotic tree of life, but they are definitely so similar that we think that the last common ancestor already had these structures, and then you have some diversification within different branches. So because they are so important, they have to be made in a regular way so that cells ensure that they always have these structures. And so what you do is that in coordination with the cell cycle, centrosomes are assembled. So for example, if you look at the dividing cell, which today you've seen a lot from Dan, you can see that at each pole of the spindle, you have one centrosome, each one with two centrioles. And then this cell will divide. So you have one cell here with one centrosome with two centrioles, which then can form a cilia or not. And then this centrosome will start forming two new centrioles so that they will elongate, so that then in mitosis you have two centrosomes. Okay? And this process is highly regulated so that in a dividing cell, you will end always in mitosis with four centrioles with very similar size, and that's quite important. And this occurs always once per cell cycle, so that in one centriole per mother centriole, and they become of equal length, and so it's highly, highly controlled. However, as I was today asking Dan about cell division, it's the same for centrioles, and which is that if you look at different tissues, you have different things, okay, within one single body. So dividing cells have this system where you always multiply your centrioles to have the same number in cell division. But if you have a cell like a cell with multiple cilia, then you have to assemble tons of these structures, and then you have a complete different way of assembling the structures. But also you have cells like the egg where you lose the centriole so that the dividing cell does not have centrosomes at all. So it's really different, and also cell division is different. For example, if we look at Drosophila, if you look at different tissues, you'll have different centrosomes, different centrosome-forming cycles, and also different cell cycles. Some cells will arrest in a certain stage of the cell cycle, while other cells will arrest in a complete different stage. So the projects that we want to address here is how do these structures evolve and how do they contribute to evolution? And we have two different questions. So one project is across species. How do they evolve across different species? And the other one is in disease. How do they evolve in disease and how do they contribute to disease? So the first project is really this project in terms of comparing across species. So this is the idea is to pick all the goodies that Cassandra brought and that we have no idea of, and really take advantage of that because we know a lot about Drosophila because our lab works a lot in Drosophila, and we know a lot about cell cycle and centrosomes in Drosophila. And we have a lot of tools to address this, but we think it would be a lot of fun to compare now these things. We know how they vary within a single fly, but we've no idea how they came to be in the different insects. So we think it could be really fun to compare and describe and compare the centrosome cycle and the cell cycle in insects and correlate that with phylogeny and redevelopment. And so the idea for this is really that, so Katarina brought a lot of fantastic tools to look at the centrosomes and the cell cycle in flies that we can use in the other insects, but it's to team up with Cassandra to look at the different insects, the way that Cassandra told you about. We can also do quantitation analysis of the processes if we piggyback on Dan. And if we are also interested in comparing how these different mechanisms are. We know how they are coded in Drosophila, how the different molecules participate in the process. So we could even compare those molecules across different phylogenetic groups if Zay teams up with us also to look into that. So you can have different ways of addressing this. And so this is just a film from Katarina, where again, here we are looking at Drosophila and we are looking at a syncytial embryo. And you can see the centrosomes here, which are labeled in green, which are molecule, which is actually a trigger of central biogenesis. And this was what one was already done with CRISPR, so it's the endogenous protein. And you can look at the spindles. And so we brought, to look at these structures, we brought many different things. So we can label spindles with the dyes that label the spindles. We can label actin. We can label the centrosomes by injecting RNA for elements of the centrosome, DNA, actin, cytoskeleton in the early embryos, and quantitate them in time and space. We can, as Cassandra said, we can perturb the cytoskeleton and even perturb the centrosome. So we can now induce more centrosomes or deplete centrosomes because we have drugs that do that. And we can ask how relevant are the structures for development, for example. And of course, we can, because their genomes are known, we can compare the machinery because we know the machinery that at least in Drosophila and in humans drives these processes across. So the other project is how did these structures and processes evolve in disease, and in particular cancer, and how they may contribute to cancer evolution. And so this will be really taken by Gael Marteil, who is there at the back. And the idea would be that we could also quantitate and analyze the process in collaboration with Anne, and also compare molecular mechanisms with Zay, if they team along. And the rationale for all these processes is based on this. So already long ago, there was this guy called Boffery, which suggested that perhaps if you have too many centrosomes, which are here on an egg, which was fertilized by more than one sperm cell, you can really have a normal cell division. And he suggested that this could contribute to cancer. And meanwhile, people have seen centrosome aberrations in cancer in the sense that they've seen cells with too many centrosomes or with a aberrant structure, and also cilia aberrations in cancer. And so the question is really, what do they do? Here you are going to see a film with a cell that has too many centrosomes. So this is just a nuclei, and you're going to see the cell dividing. And so if you see the cell dividing abnormally in three, yeah, what you will see is that it's not very happy. Yeah? So the question really becomes, you know, if you have too many of these structures in cancer, what's the point if the cells are just going to die? You know, what's the advantage for cancer to have too many of these structures? However, something that people have seen also is that if you have a cell with too many centrosomes in cancer, so this cell has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and if you observe now this cell dividing, what you'll see is that the cell is quite smart, because what it does is actually that it clusters the centrosomes at the tuple so that now it can divide normally into two daughter cells and survive. And actually, what people have described is that in the process of doing this, you can have abnormal chromosome segregation. But instead of being really a massive catastrophe, it's only like losing one chromosome, which could actually provide advantages for the cell in terms of proliferation. Okay? The other thing that people have observed is that if you have cells with too many centrosomes. So normally, if you make a mammosphere, which is basically epithelial cells from the breast, they would make just a mammosphere and they are quiet. But if they have too many centrosomes, they can have invasive properties, as you see here, okay, where they extend protrusions. So actually, having too many centrosomes could be advantages for cancer cells for invading properties, but also if they can adapt to that, they could actually generate an aneuploidy, which could be advantageous in terms of generating diversity. Okay? And so nowadays, people are actually starting to target centrosomes in human breast cancer. So this really raises a lot of questions. So one of them is that if you have altered centrosomes, if you could have a lot of cell death, but it could have more genetic variation and more evasion. So it's really, what's the balance between these in cancer, okay? And it could be that they really all die unless you have what I've shown you, which is all these coping mechanisms that they have, which is kind of clustering them, and other ones that we can discuss further. Or you could imagine that perhaps you have only a small proportion of the cells within a population that have multiple centrosomes, which would, for example, contribute to invasion, even if they afterwards die, if you're always generating a small proportion like this, okay? And you have like a steady state of generating these cells, cells dying, but you always have a certain proportion which is essential for the population to survive or to be more aggressive in the cancer. Yes, so I'm finishing. So the idea is, through these mechanisms, could you actually even change the balance not to be equal, but really to be advantageous for the cancer cell to have altered centrosomes? And what Gael did was actually to do, so Gael picked a panel of 60 different cancer cell lines across all the different tissues and quantified the number of normalities that they have in terms of centrosomes. And here you can see like a normal dividing cell with two centrosomes. And this one is a cancer cell with already too many green dots, which are the centrosomes, but they are clustered. You see some that are really not clustering at all, so we wonder how these ones are dividing. And these ones, which are very clever, they just extrude them so that, you know, you still have a bipolar spindle, but you have more centrosomes, so they could contribute to something else, for example, evasion. So the other thing that we have done was in the lab, we collaboration with other labs, we've done studies in vivo looking at human patient samples, looking at breast and esophageal cancer, okay, and quantifying the centrosome numbers there. And we had these really striking observations, which is that in most of the cancer cell lines, you have abnormal centrosomes. However, it's never like 100%, like it's something that is really selected for, okay? But it's also rarely 0%. So you always have something between like 5% and 62%, depending on the cancer cell line. Also, if we look at the studies in vivo, we also see the same thing. So for example, if you look at the esophageal cancer, we see around like between 5 and 10% alterations in centrosome number. And if we look at the breast cancer, we see, depending on the subtype, so the less aggressive type, which is luminal, we see around 8% of the cells have changes. Where if we look at the basal type, it's very variable. It's an average of 22%, but some of the patients really had more amplification, okay, suggesting that it correlates with aggressivity. So this really raises a lot of tissue, of a lot of questions. So is there a magic number for different tissues, for different cell lines to be able to proliferate more? Or is it just, you know, it doesn't really matter for the cells and they are just there, these abnormalities. So what does this really mean, these numbers that we are observing? And this is what we want to test. So the first thing, is there a magic number? Does it confer proliferative advantages to the cells? And how do cells cope with many centrosomes? And we have more tools to address the first two ones than the second one. So the first one, for example, we can actually reset the centrosome number in these cell lines to zero. So we can deplete centrosomes with a pharmacological tool, and then we can ask, can they go back to the same number? Is there a magic number for the cell lines? And actually, recent published data from Karen Igema's group suggests that that's the case, that there's a magic number for each cell line. And we can actually look at the dynamics of this process. Is that the balance between cell death and the cells arising with many centrosomes? How do you achieve this magic number, and what does it mean? The other thing is, does it confer proliferative advantages? So here, what we can do is actually, for example, mix populations of cells with more centrosomes and cells with less centrosomes, because we can induce more centrosomes in cells, and ask, you know, is there a ratio of cells which would confer proliferative advantages to a population if you compare with cells with no centrosome, with no changes, and cells with where all have changes, okay? So we can actually do a lot of mixing and matching to ask whether is there synergy or competition in cell proliferation if you change centrosome numbers. And finally, we do have different cell lines that have different ways of coping with multiple centrosomes, so we could actually look into them and see how they divide and look at their centrosomes. So we have, as tools, we have different cancer cell lines, and we have the ability to make more or less centrosomes and reset their number. So we have, we can do live imaging on these cells also, and we have ability to combine populations with different characteristics because we can label them in different ways so that we know which are the cells with more and which are the cells with less. And we have the ability of cloning dividing cells, which is something that labels these cancer cells. Spinal. And that's it.
Thank you.
I'm Giuseppe Daniel, everybody calls me Seth, so let's just not get confused. I occasionally feel the odd one out because I'm a bioinformatician. I trained as a biochemist. I see the world very much as a protein-based world, protein doing stuff, and then phenotype is what happens after proteins do their stuff. I heard about DNA, it's a myth. And what I've been interested in over the years is in compartmentalization. It's something when you look down the microscope, or actually paper, and you see those beautiful pictures, what really strikes me are things that separate you from each other in many different ways. I hope to give you a talk about these in a week or two. And I've been looking at this topic for quite a while. And the one thing that, before I go into the topic that I'm going to discuss, that we're going to be doing in this project, is that because we're very much generic protein biochemists, we've done this in another graduate course, actually approach there and say, we do whatever you want. In the sense, they tell us what is your research project, we come up with something that you can do around your research project that involves such as more comparative genomic stuff. This worked out a couple of years ago at the MBL. We did one project, the idea was actually that one of mine, but that is now published. It was just accepted yesterday. I was very happy. And this is a lot of fun, but it was a lot of fun to take projects that just start from scratch. And just the student comes up with an idea, or in our case, our idea was really fuzzy. And then you just build it up until it's a complete idea, and you generate the preliminary data, and then we finished it in the lab. Now, I told you that my interest is compartmentalization. So, and I've been for over the years studying many different systems, and at some point I started realizing that, you know, at some point you start focusing on one system. And in collaboration with Monica, who is here, with Wallace and there, and many other people, we've been actually trying to generate tools, sort of more of a conceptual framework to help organize phenotypic diversity. I'm not going to talk about this today, it's really awesome. I think in a couple of weeks or so, we might have some more tools-oriented discussion. But the point is that we've been cataloging morphological diversity, and this is what these end topics, microtubule organizing centers that Monica was talking about. And phenotype is awesome. You know, phenotypic variation is awesome. And that's one thing that really strikes me, is that no offense, that between a cricket and a Drosophila, I don't see that much difference. Because
you weren't paying attention.
If you want to see a difference, so Dan was telling you about when he was asked, what is the most weird spindle you've seen in your life? I think you were describing this.
No,
not that. That's a closer picture. Anyway, this is a dinofly, so it has an external spindle. Notice how the kinetosome, elsewhere known as the centrosome, is outside and is just blowing there. But what we normally call the centrosome is these cylinders with the pericentriolar material around. Well, that pericentriolar material is here. There's other stuff here. That's very interesting. This is a dinoflagellate. This is an important word for you to remember. This is a cross-section of TM of a diatome. Diatomes are something that's really weird, is that they don't even have centrosomes. You have this ball and a center that seems to organize. And then at some point, it makes something called polar caps that starts nucleating these fibers, microtubule fibers, and makes these structures. This is a very weird spindle compared to what we do. It's completely different, right? It's a diatom. They're all very different from each other. Now, so what we decided to do in our lab,
Yes,
because that is the machine. If you don't recognize the jet speaker, it's over there. You don't know this. So what we decided actually, that's why. So not only a few years ago we decided let's focus on morphological phenotypic variation, let's start focusing more on these microtubule-derived organelles, and this is collaboration with Monica, what we start feeling is the need to focus on specific organisms from which we can add value and actually understand this diversity. And this is where Ricardo comes into the lab. And this is basically why we're actually building, not only that we can do whatever we want, but maybe we want to do the stuff that we'd like to do, which is to study diversity, variation, plasticity in cell biology in marine unicellular eukaryotes. Now, I just want to make sure that it is, I brought this quickly, these definitions from Wikipedia. I know there's a lot of physicists in the room just to make sure you're all on board. So, you know, genotype, that's basically the code. Phenotype is what happens when you run the code and interact with your environment. But then there's something that interesting happens, is that when you run that, when you look at all of us, we're all different from each other. In this case, we talk about variation, and we're different between species. We tend to, the words that we use are can be a bit confusing sometimes. Some people use variation to describe only within species differences, whereas some people call it also cross species. Let's say variation within species differences and diversity across species differences. And then there's yet another, and this variation or diversity can be accounted by the code, or somehow the modulated by the code, modulated by, how the code is run and how it interacts with the environment. And this is we're talking about phenotypic plasticity. So these are the words that would be relevant for this course, because what we'd like to do is to take these two model systems, diatoms, beautiful, dinoflagellates, which are even more beautiful. They're really, really awesome. Just to situate you, I know Joel is not here, but you probably freak out with this tree, because these three branches have different colors. But this is the SAR group that we told you about. So animals are here. All our enormous diversity is that branch. We'll be talking about this other group here that diverged probably about 2 billion years ago. And we'll be looking at alveolata, which will be here. So this would be the dinoflagellates would be somewhere here. And somnophiles, the diatoms would be here. So these are the two groups that we'll be bringing here. They're very diverse, very, very far away from animals. The reason why they're so interested, and for us as a lab, we decided to move into this, is because for a variety of reasons. One of them, I'm very interested in this notion of cells within cells. And these guys have gone through repeated rounds of endosymbiosis. Just to give you an idea, that every single one of them is a eukaryotic cell with another eukaryotic cell living inside them. Every single one of them. And some of them actually have multiple layers. Actually, dinoflagellates exist in which you have a dinoflagellate that lives inside another dinoflagellate. These are insane. And these are actually the well-behaved guys here, because if you go to this group here, then it goes completely crazy. But I won't go there. Besides that, they have the property of being, they go to most of the oxygen, a lot of the oxygen that we breathe is produced by diatoms. They are relevant in all sorts of ways. So what we'd like to do is basically take this organism and tell me what we brought to the lab so that we can define what to do, and basically discuss what would be relevant questions in terms of variation and plasticity, and how we can use these organisms to address them. How are we going to do this? So what did we bring here? We brought a kit to sample phytoplankton from the local environment. For those of you that want field trips, it's a very sophisticated material. and involves very, very, very glamorous expositions. And so we are equipped to do that. We've brought reagents to the lab to basically take that and actually figure out what it is. We need to do, because of time constraints, relatively simple PCR-based approaches. We have all the reagents here and we have the equipment here. We brought live and fixed cultures of those diatoms and dinoflagellates. We brought panicked diatoms, and you'll see why we're so interested in these ones, and some really cool dinoflagellates. This one in particular is particularly interesting because it has one full enslaved diatom living inside. This is awesome, one of these. And then there's all these bioinformatics. So for these two, there are available transcriptomes, full transcriptome data. For these, don't even think about it. They are aliens, really. And bear in mind that there's loads and loads of publicly available information and tools that for us to just come up with something on the spot is not complex. One thing I want to do is, we're not going to tell you, this is a project. What you want to do, we don't like that. I think it's boring. You guys are graduate students, most of you are more advanced than that. The idea, but we have blocks of work that I'm thinking to fitting into questions. So sampling characteristics in terms of characterizing diversity, to look at inter-versus interspecific variation on cellular morphology. So these are the things that we know we are now doing in the lab. We can grow these things, we can measure them. We don't have the quantitative data that we need, and hopefully we can do something here just to give you an idea These are the two diatoms that we brought. And if you, obviously this is scanning EM, so it's not going to be the type of data to produce. Point is that they have a size difference that characterizes them. The point is that what we don't know is that every time diatoms divide, they become smaller and smaller and smaller. So size is not a cell constant. So even characterizing the size in a population is no longer just averaging size. It's something a bit more sophisticated. You need to think about how to do this. So that's the challenge. How are you going to classify and then actually define the methods to characterize size variation? Something as simple as size variation, no, length versus width, and actually asking a question which is to what extent they are dependent on each other, independent variables. And then there's the issue of environmental plasticity. We know, so this is silica dyes, so the diatoms that we brought, the dinoplasmids that we brought, they have the armored dye, they're actually called armored because they have these cellulose-based plates around. These ones in particular, these diatoms have silica shells, and we know that the properties of this shell is highly dependent on environmental variables. This is very relevant for climate change and all that, but we are equipped to actually test some of these variables here. Again, not very sophisticated experimental setup. I think it's more the conceptual setup that's going to be fun. And then this is the one stuff that we've Ricardo has done some experiments. Yes, he's now one of the few people that can grow diatoms under confocal microscopes and multiple generation image cycles. Stanley can do some of these things. In a lab in Germany, in which he's the only person using that confocal, which I don't think is going to happen yet. But this is something where we'd really like to go and actually look into what do these things look inside? What is the cytoskeleton organization? We have two experts here. We can. Dan and Monica would love to work with them. With them, and I know that both of them would also be keen to play. And then there's this issue of comparative genomics. So for example, here, to understand the genetic basis of these differences, so interspecific variation. So just for information, this paper that the students did at the NBL was about the size of rods, of protein rods that determine the distance between organelles and all that. And the idea was to look at the transcriptomes of these diatoms and ask, for example, can you understand why is it that they have these different sizes, looking at these spacers, these sort of spacing proteins in the cell, and then, do whatever you want. So the bottom line, so this is hard to try to tell in project when you're really coming here with the explicit point of doing anything you want to do. This is what we'd like to do, so that's fine. So yes, we can give you a project if you are just want to go straight into the lab and do something, but hopefully we want to sit down and discuss them. This is the idea, this is how we see this problem. Then we iterate a little bit until we have a question, and the idea is that in 2 weeks you're going to be standing here very proudly and saying, I had this very deep intellectual question, and I won't promise that. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm going to be working on diatoms. I didn't prepare like an actual presentation, but I'll just chat. So hopefully you guys were working this morning. stuff that we're doing. So, based on this kind of evolutionary work that we've gotten involved with, I say both Riz and I have become incredibly interested on within species variation, particularly as it relates to cell developmental biology. And so I think within species variation, it's both, like as I hopefully illustrate to some extent, like a powerful window on learning about evolutionary biology, and in fact, that's or a lot of like real evolution biology is done is within species variation.
Hey, you left it on the microphone, I'm sorry.
Oh.
Did you forget? Did you work?
I didn't.
Oh, sorry.
Thought the room was small enough.
Well, no,
it's recording.
It's not a microphone. It's just for recording.
Okay. So a lot of real evolutionary biology is of course done with within species variation, and And so that's a powerful window on learning about evolution of cell and developmental characteristics. And then, like I was alluding to as well, I also believe that it's a really powerful approach to address mechanistic issues too. And so for example, you know, like normally when we do genetic experiments in lab, right, or some type of perturbation experiment, like if you want to learn how does the cell relate to the size of the cell, relate to the size of the spindle, the way you would do this in lab is that you would, you know, find some gene which affects cell size, you would knock that down, and then you would see that the cell size changed and the spindle size changed, and you try to draw some conclusion from that. Well, when you have natural diversity, what you can do now is now you can have many, many different lines where you have quantitative variation in, for example, cell size, and quantitative variation in, for example, spindle size, and then try to understand how do these relate together. And so, just to give you like one indication of where one could go with that type of thing, if one is considering the spindle as one example. So like, let's pretend you have the following model, that you think the size of the cell determines the size of the centrosomes, and the size of the centrosomes determines the size of the spindle, right? So if that was what you believe was going on, it's certainly true that if you knock down one gene that changes the size of the cell, you would also see the change in those two other attributes as well. But there are many other models which could give you that same result. On the other hand, if you had quantitative variation across many, many, many lines, and one saw that one had a quantitative measurement of cell size, centrosome size, and spindle size in all those lines, one could ask, first of all, are these correlated across lines? If so, that's consistent with that model. But more importantly, if that model is really correct, then that would predict that if you look at the relationship between the spindle size and cell size conditioned on centrosome size, they are now uncorrelated, right? In other words, the spindle, if that model is correct, only talks to cell volume through the centrosome size, right? And so this provides a very powerful, general approach to getting, increased mechanistic insight. But one, issue is that for cellular traits and developmental traits, we actually know very, very little about the extent of within species variation for nearly everything. And so then one question is that how much do we have, right? So Reza characterized, I believe, very well for this, first cell division in C. elegans, but is there something special about C. elegans? Is there something special about the first cell division? And so, what we are proposing to do is address that issue in flies for other cellular and developmental traits. And so, I actually don't work on flies, so this was a fun opportunity for me as well. Reza knows what he's doing with flies, and so I'm learning from him as well as Monica and Cassandra. And then what we brought is essentially part of a panel. Which was designed for looking at within species variation in flies. And so this particular panel was created by Trudy McKay, where what she did was that she collected a number of flies, essentially from the wild, and then made them together a whole bunch of different times to kind of mix up their genes. And then she had roughly 200 different lines, which had different combination of genes of these original founders. And so now you can have this panel of lines, and they're all sequenced. And so now you have this panel of lines, and now you can start asking about how much variation do you have across this panel. And so hypothetically, one could do the type of experiments I was talking about. So for example, one can start asking about, if you look at gastrulation in different natural isolates or across this line, to what extent do you have variation in gastrulation? And also, for what extent is this variation in gastrulation correlated with size of the embryo or other attributes of interest? And hypothetically, one could actually map the basis of that variation. So it's figure out what the genetics of that is. So I think it's unlikely that given the limited time of the course, that we'll actually do real mapping. But who knows? It may be possible. And so then, what we brought is essentially 40 to 50 of these different lines. And what the plan is to essentially characterize them for things which we or you think are interesting. And so, to what extent is there variation in cellularization? To what extent is there variation in gastrulation? To what extent is there variation in the biophysics of the wing, of wing formation, or the eye? And so our goal is to both like look, you know, to see what we can see, but then also hopefully again try to connect up to some amount of biophysics of this. And so for example, actually Reza has done in his PhD, he worked with Frank Bielker to do biophysical models of the wing and how cells behave in the wing. And so can one start measuring how much differences you have in those type of attributes across the wings and try to learn something. And so some of that one can do just with non-fluorescence microscopy, just by, imaging what one can image. But then also, we have the possibility using lines and reagents, brought by other people, perhaps using dyes and these type of things to look at more molecular properties as well. And so in addition to, and then we can also look at different species too and try to compare within species variation to between species variation, this type of thing. So, we do a lot of, we have both Rez and I have a lot of experience with quantitative image analysis and also just thinking about how to analyze data. And so we are happy both to, use that in the projects that we're talking about, but also in collaboration with other people who are here. And what the hope is that we'll really have projects which will kind of span in various ways, the different groups which are here.
Okay. Great. So I don't really envy you guys. That's fantastic. It's really inspiring. I should just comment that we do have a lot of experience at this MBL place you keep hearing about where the cross-group collaborations work. And so I would think of the boundaries between your groups as very porous. So even though you're going to now give us your rankings, remember it's 1 to 5, we need your rankings on everybody, and we need to hear them by 1 p.m., and then we'll do our best to try to accommodate your interests. But the bottom line is this was so very inspiring, and thanks to the four of you.
Can I ask something? So in the case of our group, because we have the two very distinct projects, maybe it would be good if people rank project 1 or 2. You see, they're really different, because one is really the insect, the other one is the
cell. If you guys can remember that would be fine, but that's a lot of resolution that's going to be put on our shoulders, actually. This is not very easy, actually, to get this little ballet to work. So, you're welcome to do that, you guys, if you want, and if everybody says only one of the projects, then maybe we'll think about it, but it's going to be hard, I believe. So, anything else anybody wants to ask? Otherwise, we finished 15 seconds late. So, all right. Have a good lunch. See you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. here.